Today, we're taking you to Calais, the west of Scotland, rural Wales, and the Irish border to look at preparations for a no-deal Brexit. And, in opinion, Guardian columnist Aditya Chakraborty on the Davos elite and what they are afraid of.
I have just been to the Institute for Government, where the chief executive of the civil service has been speaking. He revealed that the cabinet office has plans to second deploy 5,000 civil servants to a command and control centre in a no-deal scenario. What is the country doing? It's like we're on a war footing.
We're going to take you to the four corners of the UK. First, crossing the world's busiest shipping channel into Dover, England. Then up to a fishing port on the west coast of Scotland, before heading west to the hill farms of Wales and, finally, along the roads that pass from Northern Ireland through to the Republic.
Out there, outside Westminster, there is a parallel universe where people are really stressed, really worried about their businesses, about planning, about no deal.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the Brexit frontline, where people have started to prepare for no deal. As MPs debate ways to prevent no deal and as businesses start to put in place contingency plans, we begin with The Guardian's Brexit correspondent, Lisa O'Carroll, who crossed from Calais to Dover with a lorry driver who makes that journey day in, day out.
We wanted to get the experience ourselves that the truck driver has on the Dover-Calais Strait. It is the busiest stretch of sea in Europe, the busiest port. It's the most important gateway to the UK for manufacturing, for cars, for supermarkets. There are something like between 6 and 10,000 trucks a day. It's absolutely massive.
We're stationary now. How long do you think we're going to be in this buffer zone? This is the queue for the queue, you said.
This is the queue for the queue. I would hope less than half an hour.
So we found a truck driver who was willing to take us
perhaps another half an hour, maybe an hour.
His name is Simon Wilkinson. He was 56. He's been in the business for 36 years. Runs a fleet of 18 trucks. They're all fridge trucks, so they bring in frozen food and chilled food, mostly for pubs, schools, restaurants, stuff like that.
So you're in the cab in Calais with Simon. Tell us about the journey across to Dover.
So we were lucky because we were in a fridge truck, so that's a hard-sided truck, and obviously the goods on board are perishable. So we were triaged and went straight through to the next check, whereas the soft-sided trucks could be carrying anything. We were sent off in another direction into this extraordinary Disneyland queue that went zigzag for kilometres, we were told later by one of the truck drivers that we met.
Just a moment here now. See, they were going into this hard...
Get through the buffer zone, and then you're into a kind of four-stage check. First stage is the weigh-in. You're on a weighbridge. You drive onto this bridge. Your weight, 44 tonnes, that's fine. That's within the rules. And then the next thing is really interesting, what they call the heartbeat scanner, i.e. for stowaways on the truck. So we clear there, and then you've got the normal immigration, French passport checks, British passport checks, and then you get to your shipping.
The scanning facility can't accommodate.
So it took us to go through those checks, it took us an hour and a quarter, and he said that that was record time for him. It can take up to 9 hours. But what's interesting then is we drive along to the ferry, and we're in queue number 155, and Simon told us there are over 500 lanes in Calais, and that gives you the scale, each of them carrying 10 to 12 trucks. So at any point, you could have 2,000 trucks in Calais.
Explain as it goes on what they're doing.
He wanted it to become common knowledge that Calais was this enormous operation at the moment, and throw a spanner into the works there with Brexit and you could have chaos.
It's difficult to try and envisage because we don't know, nobody's told us what they're going to do.
It doesn't take much. They've said before, 2 minute delay equals 27 kilometres of queues on both sides.
And during your time there, you met other truck drivers also from Britain. What did they say?
The two other guys that I met on the ferry were absolutely passionate leavers. They're quite relaxed about the prospect of checks. They say everything is barcoded, everything is scanned, there's GPS on their trucks. All governments know, you know, they're effectively electronically documented. But specifically, the reason they voted leave is because they feel, and there was very much evidence of this in Calais, that the haulage industry is now dominated by Eastern Bloc haulage companies, to the point where you have Western companies who have set up Polish, Bulgarian, Romanian operations themselves, and they go there because the wages are cheaper, insurance is cheaper, the yards are cheaper, everything's cheaper. So that has meant that British truck drivers have got fewer facilities, there are fewer work opportunities.
Okay, so Simon showed you some really serious practical concerns about the impact of Brexit, and others were much more relaxed. Overall, how ready is the haulage industry for no deal?
Well, the haulage industry does not want no deal. It says that we're down to less than 10 weeks now. It's not enough time to prepare for Brexit. It'll be chaos on the 30th of March. I know where I want to be on the 30th of March if there's no deal. It's somewhere around that border, because that's going to be where it's all going to be going wrong.
As Lisa drove into England with Simon, some of the trucks headed the other way were carrying fresh fish, which had started its journey almost 500 miles north at a Scottish fishing port where The Guardian's Scotland correspondent Libby Brooks recently visited.
I drove from my home in Glasgow west to the coast to Ardrossan and to the Clyde Marina. The sun was just coming up. I found Alistair Roberts. He was actually fitting the wheelhouse into his new fishing boat, which is called Guide Them. The name was sort of painted in very elegant gold lettering.
I built a new boat. I have a son who left school at 16. He doesn't know anything else apart from the fishing.
Alistair is the person who is out sort of all day, every day, catching prawns. Kind of when we talk about prawns, it's not just sort of wee things for scampi, it's those enormous langoustine.
And did he tell you how he had voted in the EU referendum?
Well, actually, he didn't vote in the EU referendum because he was out of the country at the time. But he told me very firmly that he would have voted to leave the EU. And I think he has that in common with the majority of other people in the fishing community, not just in Scotland, actually, but across the UK.
So the common fisheries policy, it's been destructive to the British fishing fleet. You know, it's not just two or three boats, it's communities it affects.
So he's pro-Brexit, he wants to leave the EU. Is he looking forward to it happening, or are there concerns about what impact it could have on him?
I have to say that Alistair certainly presents himself as being sort of fairly sanguine about the future, even in the event of a no deal. But if you press him a bit, you get his concerns eventually. And I think what he's particularly worried about is delays at the ports.
We're relying on the folk that buy our prawns, and they're actually relying on getting the stuff to the continent. This is going to be the biggest problem if it's a hard Brexit, is the transport side of it.
The catch that he is bringing into land is about half of it at the moment is live, and obviously those have to be transported then to sort of upmarket restaurants in France and Spain, and that has to be done as quickly as possible. So if you have, you know, even a sort of 12-hour delay at the ports, that means that entire catch is ruined, and that is going to be very, very difficult for the likes of him.
It's really interesting. So Alistair obviously has big worries about no deal. Does he think that a deal will be done?
I have to say he didn't have very much confidence in a deal being reached. I think, like a lot of people in his industry, he feels sort of quite far removed from Westminster and doesn't have a huge amount of confidence in what politicians are setting out at the moment.
I think it's a circus. The whole thing in Parliament's a circus. I think it's ridiculous. And it's got far too political.
I also spoke to Bertie Armstrong, who is the chief exec of the Scottish Fishermen's Federation, and that is the largest industry body that we have up here. He told me that he thought that we are currently suffering from, as he put it, millennium bug-itis, as far as leaving the EU is concerned. And he is very relaxed about sort of concerns people have around tariffs, delays and so forth, and sort of keeps coming back to this fact that we will be regaining sovereignty over our waters. That's what Scottish fishermen want, and that can only be a good thing.
The Guardian's Stephen Morris discovered a very different mood in rural Wales, where he travelled to a remote farm and heard fears about how a no-deal Brexit could hit livelihoods.
So I went to Ceredigion in West Wales, spoke to a farmer called Wyn Evans.
And my family have lived and been farming in the Ystwyth Valley for around 500 years.
He's now there with his wife and two children. The two children go to university at Aberystwyth. He farms with his wife, Nicole.
So we feed them, we muck them out, we do any other necessary work to the livestock.
It was a beautiful, crisp winter's day, but it felt very remote up there.
And what did he tell you about his life there?
He loved his life. He was really passionate about farming. I was really struck by that. I live out in the country, so I know a lot of farmers, and lots of them can be quite cynical and complain about their work a lot, but he utterly loved his work. He loved the history of the place.
And what impact will Brexit have on his line of work?
Well, he was very worried about it. The word he used was it could be horrific for him and for farmers like him, especially the sheep side of his business.
At the moment, my best lambs would be selling for about £75. I could see that come down to around about £30-32. That's the modelling that we've seen so far. So it would be absolutely disastrous.
He worries that if tariffs on lamb come on, it's just going to decimate his business.
We export 31% of our red meat product from the UK, and 94% of that goes to the EU. And if we don't get that unfettered access and free trade with them, we won't have that element of competition. And we just need to look back at the foot and mouth here.
He saw the same thing back when there was the foot and mouth crisis and the borders shut. And at that time, the price of lamb collapsed, and that became very difficult for him and for his colleagues.
A lot of people who work and live in the countryside rely on farming for their income, but you know, it would be absolutely devastating for the industry as well.
And so he was really worried that if there's a no-deal Brexit, that it could have a big impact on his livelihood.
Exactly that. He said in farming you can't make many preparations for this.
We're not investing strongly in our business now because we don't know what's going to happen.
He has reduced his flock of sheep slightly from around 400 to around 370. Just to kind of get the numbers a little bit lower in preparation. And at the same time, he's increased the number of cattle he's got there because he thinks the price of beef might hold a bit better. So that was one way he could prepare. But he said he couldn't store a load of grain or a load of food. It just didn't work like that in farming. It's a bit hand-to-mouth, really.
And how worried was he?
He was worried.
But, you know, I am very, very concerned. I want my family to carry on living in the Ystwyth Valley for another 500 years, if that's at all possible. We've seen land abandonment before. We see farming families move away from the communities. If we lose those kind of people from the countryside, it would be disastrous for social implications of that, especially within Wales, where the language and culture are so strong.
What he did say was, look, this farm's been here for hundreds of years. He thinks it'll survive. He thinks his son, if he wants to come into farming, and the son's thinking about doing it, will have a business to carry on with, but genuinely worried about it.
I definitely want to, you know, secure my business for the next generation.
What did he make of the entire Brexit debate that's obviously going on in Westminster?
Frustration was the word he kept using. He's frustrated how it's going. I thought perhaps he'd feel very isolated from Westminster and asked him about that because of the remoteness of the place. But he said, no, I follow the whole thing. He felt engaged in the process, but is frustrated that it can't be sorted out. He was quite into the idea of Theresa May's deal that got knocked down a few weeks ago. He thought that would work for farmers and for the businesses in Wales. So I think he thinks that if there's some sort of deal, it could still work for them.
Do you think that sheep and cattle farmers in Wales are ready for no deal?
I don't think they are. They say they just can't prepare for it in the way they'd like to. They've just got to hope, I think.
There's uncertainty too across the Irish Sea, where few want to see a return to the hard border of the past and the memories it brings. Ireland correspondent Rory Carroll accompanied a dairy farmer on his daily journey from the Republic into Northern Ireland and back again.
I hitched a ride with Pat Haskins.
We'll talk away for a minute there anyway.
Who is a very personable truck driver, and several times a week he drives a milk truck, 27,500 litres of milk each time, from Southern Ireland up through and around Dublin and right on up to the border and into County Tyrone. And there he offloads the milk and then he drives the truck back again. Now that milk eventually is processed in the north and then shipped back to the south of Ireland for distribution here.
Is it like crossing a border from one country to another when you were with him?
It's remarkably unremarkable. I mean, blink and you can miss it.
The movement, like, is just free. You just drive straight through. There's no hold-up.
The route that he takes, it's through Auchnacloy. It's a little village just on the northern side. I mean, there is a river, the River Blackwater, but it's a tiny river. The bridge, you cross it in about 15 seconds. There's nothing to indicate that you've left the Republic of Ireland and entered the United Kingdom at all. The only sign of that is literally in the road signs.
And you just go from kilometres into miles per hour. That's about the only thing that tells you you're into a different country.
There's no customs posts, border posts, no sign of soldiers or anything, and zero checks. I mean, he's been doing this for nigh on three decades, and he remembers what the border was like before the Good Friday Agreement, when there were British military checkpoints, when there were customs posts. He would first have to drive into Dundalk, a town on the southern side, to get paperwork, and then he'd cross over, and then he'd drive to Newry on the northern side and do more checks there before getting permission to continue on into Northern Ireland, and do it all over again when he was driving back from the north into the south. And his term was nightmare, you know, bloody nightmare. And so for him now, when he's driving back up, it almost seems unreal, because he looks out his window and he sees there's the river, there's little donkeys just out grazing on the northern side.
We don't want to lay it. We're out in the lovely green countryside. Fields are as green as if it was the middle of spring and still winter.
And to think that just in a few short weeks, this could become the only land frontier between the European Union and the United Kingdom, and the idea that there could be, suddenly we're back to checkpoints, customs posts, to him is just, it's a head wrecker, is another term he used.
It's all, is it just one big question mark? Well, we definitely don't want the border.
And he's just wondering and worried about what this may mean for him.
And what impact could Brexit have on his line of work?
Delay, 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 he said. And for a truck driver, they'll all tell you the same thing, time is money.
Really, we don't want delays. We have a job to do, and we like to get out and do it and have as little hassle as possible.
Meaning that he thinks that they could add anything from maybe 30 minutes to 3 hours on a daily route. And that may not sound a big deal, but if that's your daily work, that's a huge deal. And if you multiply that across the whole freight industry in Southern and Northern Ireland and the agricultural sector, I mean, this affects so many different industries. I mean, for example, Bailey's, the cream liqueur, their trucks have to crisscross the border 6 times to make a Bailey's cream. And same with Guinness as well, because they produce the Guinness on one side, but they bottle it in another side.
And is there any way to put a financial figure on the impact?
No. I mean, figures are flying around, but the head of the Irish Exporters Association, in a briefing last week, he used the somewhat less technical term that the Republic of Ireland would be screwed, was his term, you know, if there was a hard border or a no-deal crash out. And screwed is a good way to put it, because so much depends on the unknowables.
Rory, do you think the dairy industry is ready for a no-deal Brexit?
Up to a limited point, yes, in that the Republic of Ireland government has been quite active in trying to prepare and brief industries, trying to explain the paperwork that may happen, and just certainly give people a crash course in world trade rules. So they won't be starting from scratch, but no one in the Republic of Ireland or the North is suggesting that they are ready.
Oh, we really don't know what. We just don't know. We can't do nothing. We can't do anything to prepare.
So, Lisa, you're Brexit correspondent for The Guardian. You've been working on this story, this crazy story, for the last 2 years. We're nearly there. Is the country ready for no deal?
The country is absolutely not ready for no deal. The country was not prepared for the result of the referendum in 2016. It's been playing catch up ever since, and it will never get there by March the 29th.
And if there is a deal?
If there is a deal, well, I think there will be a period where people will pause to take breath. And I'm convinced we'll be back into the same sort of weeds again quite soon in trade negotiations.
Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, you may have noticed that the Brexit story is not going away yet. You can follow all the reporting from Guardian teams across the country on the website. Coming up, Aditya Chakraborty argues that when 26 billionaires, who would just about fill a Davos minibus, own as much wealth as half the planet's population, something is going seriously wrong.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian subscriptions.
Now, Guardian columnist Aditya Chakraborty on why the Davos elite are the problem and not the solution.
I've been an economics journalist of one kind or other for over two decades now, and I can report that there are not two but three certainties in life, because every year around this time, the world's ultra-rich and powerful gather in the Swiss Alps, and over the course of 3 days, they spend time debating the future of the rest of us, the future of humanity. And what you'll typically get is you'll be watching television and on the news, someone will turn up, normally heading a big company or running a finance ministry, and tell us what the rest of us have in store for the rest of our lives, whether it's robots taking our jobs or globalisation or the rise of China. But this year, there's a bit of a twist. Because the annual report that's been put out by the people who organised Davos begins with this rather plaintive question. Is the world sleepwalking into a crisis? And it's obvious that the people who wrote the report think so. So there's a survey of 1,000 corporate bosses, money managers and other Davos decision makers. And in that, over 9 in 10 say that they fear some kind of trade war or other economic confrontation between major powers. Then they confess to mounting anxieties about populism, nativist agendas, and public anger against elites. There's a general sense of turmoil which the elites can neither comprehend nor control. And amid this political earthquake, they identify two great tectonic plates that are shifting. One is climate change, which is always nice to hear from a summit that has something like 1,500 private jets flying into it. And the other is increasing polarisation of societies. And this strikes me in its barefaced blame shifting, in its sheer effrontery. This is akin to arsonists wailing about the bonfire they've just started. Because if you want an example of polarisation, well, you need look no further than the report this week from Oxfam, which points out that 26 billionaires. That's about as many people as can fit inside a reasonably sized minibus, own as much as half the world's humanity. Not only that, the collective wealth of the billionaire class is growing by $2.5 billion a day. So there is, by definition, a kind of economic polarisation that's far more obscene than any of the social or political polarisation that worries the billionaire class at Davos, and indeed, I would argue, is primarily responsible for causing the polarisation that they're worried about. But obviously, some kinds of polarisation are more acceptable than others. The problem with the concern of the super rich is it's always done on their terms, and it's always done on the premise that they're not part of the problem, which, in my view, they are. So it was Ronald Reagan who said that the nine most terrifying words in English language were, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Now, that's a gag, but in a way it sets a tone for a lot of what's followed in decades since, which is a preference of the private sector over the public sector, wherever and whenever possible, a general distrust of the public realm, Silicon Valley solutionism, a belief that software engineers can somehow deal with inequality and climate change and everything else, and a sense that the little guy, you and me, shouldn't worry our little heads too much about what's going on in the world. We should just leave it to the elites to manage the world order. Well, we've seen how that's gone, from the banking crash to austerity to depression visited upon parts of Europe to the current crumbling of the political and social order. And I would suggest that there's actually a new contender for the nine most terrifying words in English language, which would be, "I'm from the elite and I'm here to help."
That's it for today. Here is a big, big thank you for so many great contributions from Lisa O'Carroll, Libby Brooks, Stephen Morris, Rory Carroll, Simon Wilkinson, Wynne Evans, Alistair Roberts, Pat Haskins, and Aditya Chakraborty. Today's episode was produced by Mithali Rao, Elizabeth Cassin, Amar Kalia, and Rose Dallarabiti. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.